Monster Man, Special Episode, Immortality. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Paul. If you'd like to be like Paul and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for all other membership tiers, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. While I'm thanking Patreon backers, let me thank two new backers. So please welcome new patrons, Nadriel and Jeremy Strandberg. Thank you both. Your support means a lot to me. All right, let's talk about Paul's premise. He has asked me to talk about immortal creatures, not invulnerable creatures, but creatures who don't die of natural causes, don't die of old age, don't get sick, but might still be killed. And he's interested in how this would affect their worldview. I think that how it would affect behavior is really the important thing about this question, because most games, you know, immortality in real life is something that people have often searched for, tried to find the secret to. It's an important theme, but it's typically not something that comes up very much in gaming, or at least not as much as you might expect, because games typically don't take place over a time frame where characters might age or die of natural causes. I'm not saying that there are no games in which that happens. Pendragon fans, you can stop typing. But in general, games take place over shorter timescales. So we would be more interested in the ways in which being immortal changes a character's personality than the actual immortality of that character. Does that make sense? Now, in particular, in this episode, I'm going to focus on the ways in which that immortality might make somebody monstrous, might make them an antagonist, because this is a show about monsters, and that's what we focus on. So, right now, I'm running for my D&D group the scenario Crypts of Indormancy, and a lot of that focuses on the way that the setting's elves think about humans and other mortals, which they call the perishing races. And in that setting, the elves are very much baddies, although they are portrayed in a way that makes them a little bit more individualized. They're not just like sneering tyrants, although they are sneering tyrants. But their attitude toward humans and other mortals is very much this view that they're not really all that important, right? Their lives can be expended because they're going to die anyway. Oh, so they died? Well, how long were they going to live, Michael? 100 years? They're just hastening the inevitable. And it's a little bit like the attitude of the cold-hearted time traveler. I can't remember whether this is something that I remembered about an episode of Doctor Who or whether it's actually in an episode of Doctor Who. I think it's actually in it. They go back to Pompeii and it's about to be destroyed by the volcanic eruption. And the companion, whichever one it is, says, if you don't help those people, they're going to die. And the doctor says, they already died. You know, they've been dead for millennia. Now, this is a fun concept in the moment. It doesn't make a lot of sense if you think about it as it relates to the whole of the show, because you could say that about anybody from a time traveler's perspective. There's not something special about 21st century Earth that makes it the present. But, you know, never mind. The idea is there as well, right? Like, they seem like living, breathing people, but in fact, they're long dead. Indeed, one of the elven villains in Crypts of Indormancy is quoted as calling humans savages that live and die in the span of beasts. So their mortality is something that they share with animals, and therefore means they can be treated like animals. So we might have a culture that's strongly predisposed to view the lives of mortals as just not very valuable. This means that they could be callous and contemptuous toward those people. There's a kind of indifferent villainy, where it's not that they hate them, although I think you could argue that some of them do, but that they view them as not important. Indeed, there's a lot of kind of thinking of mortals merely as a kind of measure against which to test one's strategic skill or courage or magical ability. And this, I think, is kind of how, you know, human societies made up of perfectly normal mortal humans have tended to think of others a lot of the time, right? I'm not saying this is unique to these fictitious characters. It's something that you can portray with environmental storytelling, just in terms of like how many people's lives were expended in the construction of this dungeon. So on the one hand, an immortal society might be particularly unconcerned with the lives of mortal beings who, after all, are going to die one way or the other. It's also the case that they might be exceptionally cautious about the idea of dying themselves, that humans in real life have a complex relationship with their own mortality. Sometimes we deny it, sometimes we accept it, sometimes we just try not to think about it, but it's there. And sometimes we're devastated by the thought of it, by the idea that we will die and that the people that we care about will die as well. I mean, not just ourselves. Indeed, sometimes I think we may find our own mortality the easiest to deal with, since after all, depending on your beliefs, once we're dead, we're either going to go to a better place or we're at least not going to have to worry about it anymore. If you're immortal, I think that that might feel very, very scary. That all of this amazing potential could be lost. When someone is murdered, that's something that we think about a lot of the time. When someone dies, as we say, before their time. When someone who's older dies, you know, we have the opportunity to reflect on a life well lived or their legacy. But when a younger person dies, we think of the loss of what they could have accomplished in the future, whether that's cured cancer or simply spent more time with the people they cared about. And to an immortal being, that future potential never decreases. It's always possible that they could have done more in the future, that they could have, you know, written the great Immortalian novel, you know, met the love of their life, finally taken that trip to the barrier peaks that they'd always talked about. So if that potential were to be taken away from an immortal being, you can see how they might feel like they would be willing to do anything to prevent that. Now, I'm not trying to overstate the case here, but first, people who live a normal amount of time are already pretty averse to dying. And secondly, perhaps more importantly, we have to be a little cautious about using this in a game, because if you are a monster, you know, an antagonist in this game, the last thing we want to do is give you a motivation that is stay out of trouble, don't get into dangerous situations. That's very boring. If you have a character whose motivation is to avoid harm, most of the time they're going to avoid harm by keeping quiet and staying out of the way, and that's not very exciting. But I do think that you could use it as a motivation, especially in cases where the motivated character is off screen. So if some ancient wizard thinks that you might be the one to take him down, then they would send assassin squads after you, even if it's distasteful to them, because the value that is gained by saving their life is so great. The loss of your life is so small. People sometimes talk about QALYs, right? Quality adjusted life years. This idea that you can measure the good that something does, I think that's what it stands for, the good that something does by how many years of what kind of life it secures for how many people. It's kind of utilitarian thinking about like how to measure the positive outcomes of an action. How many years of life does it save? So obviously, if you do things like find a better way to treat a disease, or, you know, provide mosquito nets so people don't get malaria, things like that save years of life. Well, if I'm an immortal and I save an immortal's life, even my own life, then think of all the years that I'm saving, potentially infinite years. Against that, what is the cost of one mortal life? Sad to be sure, but the only reasonable choice. It's also something that you can think about in terms of like dungeon construction, right? Why is this dungeon so full of death traps and other security precautions? Well, ancient wizard absolutely terrified of getting taken out by adventurers. So far, I've been thinking about immortal individuals, whether that's people who've been granted immortality or were born that way or whatever. But when thinking about a species of immortal creatures, they might have a very different approach to focusing on tasks, right? So some of the tragedy would be gone. I watched the film The Old Guard recently, and that's got these immortal characters in it, and their big tragedy is that they have human friends, human loved ones, human families who do die, and so they have to kind of like re-experience the loss of these people to the point where the only ones they can sort of stand to be around are their fellow immortals. But in a whole society of immortals, you know, that question goes out the window. Instead, we have to think about what we're going to do with our time, because we're not going to have the kind of imagined life cycle that most mortal species will have. So if we think about how humans anticipate like the course of a life, there are stages to it. We go from childhood to youth to adulthood to old age and we have certain ideas about what is the right way to behave, what is the kind of expected thing to do in each of those as we transition from, you know, someone who is learning to someone who is doing. As we get older, we have responsibilities to a younger generation, etc., etc. But that might not be the case for these immortals. And do they focus on a single pursuit, spending centuries to master the blade or whatever? When you face an immortal soldier, are you facing someone who has spent hundreds, if not thousands of years learning about combat? Or are you facing someone who spent hundreds of years learning about architecture and then decided, well, I've learned everything about it. I've done everything I can. In our creative pursuits, we often eventually come to a point where we don't feel like we can add anything anymore. And then we move on. You know, we might have the same NPC turning up throughout history, just like in a different role every time. As the great General Petronilla once said, as the great novelist Petronilla once said, part of the problem is, I wonder if immortals might be a little boring. This is kind of the problem with elves in general. I think it's an experiential thing, maybe. But what I mean is, if you take the kind of stereotypical elven existence from Tolkien, from whatever, it's a lot of, like, gazing upon things in the moonlight and playing the harp and just, like, thinking really important thoughts. And, of course, there are wars and, you know, times of great moment and politics and so forth, but the immortals have those as well. So what is it about being immortal that makes them special? If I could go and hear this beautiful music and see these beautiful buildings instead of something that a human made to, like, imitate them, then maybe I would think, ah, this is all worth it. But instead, I just kind of feel like, yeah, these people are pretty stuck up. And therefore, they sort of feel dull. There's a sense of stasis. Now, I'm not one of those people that says, like, ah, yeah, it's the risk of death. It's mortality that gives things spice, that makes things exciting. I don't feel like that. But I do feel like that maybe as mortals, we, the creators of these things, struggle to conceive of what it would be about an immortal society that would make it so special, you know? We can't study what a society of immortals is like in real life. But can we draw any conclusions based on how people react when they are likely to live for a longer time? So, the highest life expectancies on Earth are certain countries in East Asia. So places like Japan has a very long life expectancy, Hong Kong, I think Macau has a really good life expectancy. And then also in Europe, especially in, I want to say Spain has a really high life expectancy. I think there's some countries in Scandinavia. I'd have to look it up, but, you know, but they're all like, which one is higher? Like they're matters of very small differences. These are all countries where the average life expectancy is somewhere in the 80s. Now, obviously I know that that statistic is largely a result of good medical care for infants, where, you know, what really drags life expectancy down is high rates of infant mortality. And people certainly do live to later in life, even in societies where the average life expectancy at birth is in, you know, the 50s, because it's people who die in infancy who are dragging that average way down there. But it's also the case that these countries feature good medical care for older people. And consequently, people are living active lives and being involved in things maybe longer than you would expect. I was in the chapel of my old college, Corpus Christi, here in Cambridge, the other day, and I was looking at the memorials of former masters of the college, and it was interesting to see that many of them had died in their mid to late 60s or early 70s. So these were not young people, but if we were to read about the notices of their deaths today, we'd think, oh, that's not that old. So these modern societies, which have very high life expectancies compared to their pre-modern counterparts, have some social traits in common that maybe we might also see in society where people live for a very long time. I'll come back to the masters in a moment because it's relevant to my second point. The first point is there's kind of an extended period of youth. Now, in our society, that's to do with the changing role of education, but I would suggest that the changing role of education is partly because there isn't as much of a rush to get into an individual's prime productive years. So, if you're in the US or the United Kingdom, middle-class people typically don't end formal schooling and enter the workforce until their early 20s or maybe even later. And this has pushed back by a few years the average age at which people do things. So, most obviously, things like getting married or starting a family. Because in your early life, there's a good chance that you're moving around a lot. Another thing that is a feature of these modern societies, but not necessarily to do with life expectancy. But we definitely think of, say, a 30-year-old as comparatively young in a way that 100 years ago, I don't think we would have. You know, 30 is the new 20 and all that kind of thing. So maybe for these immortals, we have this 200's the new 100 kind of situation where the early part of your life is just considered to be normal, that you're preparing to get started. And you might be getting started with your life long after a mortal of the same age has died. This is a good thing for adventurers from immortal races, this idea that elven dungeoneers are on a kind of rumspringa. They're expected to eventually go back and take their place in elven society, but you can go and clear out a few dungeons on the way there. It may also be the case, and I don't have statistical evidence to back this up, but I feel like leaders are getting older, or at least it is possible for them to be older. When I was a kid, U.S. President Ronald Reagan was sometimes satirized as a doddering old coot, you know, so old that he couldn't possibly do his job. He was 77 years old when he left office. Or Soviet leader Konstantin Chernenko was seen as an indictment of Soviet gerontocracy when he came to power at the age of 72, and he died shortly thereafter and was replaced by a younger candidate, Mikhail Gorbachev. But if Joe Biden wins the 2024 election, he will be 82 years old when he's inaugurated. And if his opponent, well, we don't know who the Republican nominee is going to be, but like, let's say it's, I don't know, Donald J. Trump. If he were to win and be inaugurated, he would be 79. I remember that in the 2020 election, we knew one thing about the winner, which is, well, we knew several things, but one of them that we knew was that it would be the oldest person ever to be inaugurated. And that would be true whichever candidate won. At just under 70, Vladimir Putin must feel quite spry by comparison, although I have to say he doesn't look it. Not that there are no young leaders, because of course there are. But in societies where it is possible, this just means that elites can stay in power a long time. Even an institution like the U.S. Senate obviously comes from a word that means an old man, right? Its name literally means the elders. But some of the elders are pretty elderly. Their median age is in the mid-60s. And for many of them, that means their careers are just beginning. And this makes sense because they're just capable of staying in those offices longer. And if the kind of apprenticeship period is getting longer at the earlier part of the political career, then maybe they feel entitled to that reward. So combine that long youth and the tendency for elites to stay in power for a long time, you have to think that ambitious immortals might incline toward frustration. The lower ranks of the sort of political hierarchy know that their odds of ever getting into one of those seats are effectively nil. How much more the case would this be in a society run by immortals, where if someone is a good grand vizier or whatever, why would you ever sack them? So people frustrated by a failure to advance in that kind of political environment might be the kind of people who are willing to take risks or do things that are unethical in order to secure their power. This also might mean that there would be political advantages to having like an expansionist empire. This might be a good time to try your luck in the colonies if you can't make it back in the metropolis because, you know, all the good jobs go to graduates of the imperial blah, blah, blah. Speaking of colonization, what do we know about our immortal species life cycle? I say speaking of colonization because, of course, maybe if you have a surplus population and lots of like younger people, colonization might be a way to relieve some of that pressure. You know, typically I would assume that a species that is naturally immortal would tend to have a relatively low birth rate or else they would overpopulate, right? Having like, that's another trend that we see in countries with very long life expectancies. Not saying that increasing life expectancy causes that, but the same factors that lead to increasing life expectancy seem to also lead to declining birth rate. People wait until they are older to have children, and consequently, they don't have as many of them. But imagine that you're a species that has a reproductive cycle that is naturally focused on having a larger number of young, and you just acquire immortality somewhere. You know, you get blessed or cursed, as the case may be. That could lead to problems. One example of a regulatory method that I've read recently was in Gareth Hanrahan's novel, The Sword Defiant, in which there are a finite number of elven souls. So elves cannot be born until a soul is available. And so therefore the wave of elven births that's happening at the time of the novel, you know, the number of elven kids there are running around is a consequence of the tremendous casualties that they sustained in a war. Now, there are, of course, immortals who have a kind of elective reproductive cycle where they can make somebody immortal. The classic example of this would be turning somebody into a vampire. And there, we have some really tricky population math. Assuming that vampires are typically self-interested, evil-aligned dirtbags who see themselves as being in competition with each other, they all have a pair of strong competing incentives. One, to maintain the supply of available humans so that they can drink their blood, and two, to make more vampires. Because in the kind of vampire Game of Thrones situation, you know, each time I make a new vampire, I gain a powerful new agent, but I put a drain on the shared food supply. So it's very important for me to prevent you from creating as many new vampires as possible, because every time you do it, it's just plain bad for me. You gain a powerful new agent, and you put a drain on the shared food supply. But if I'm going to be competing with you over access to a limited food supply, then one thing that would be super useful for me to have would be a bunch of powerful new agents. Good thing vampires can die by violence, huh? Speaking of dying by violence, I think the fear of dying by violence could motivate an immortal in a variety of different directions. I mentioned before the idea of kind of like protecting yourself as rigorously as possible. The problem is that that's turtling, which is usually not very interesting. You could have, if you're trying to do good guy immortals, then I think you could just argue that they're a peaceful society with a shared understanding of killing as a huge transgression. In real life, obviously, societies that have very high life expectancies tend to be societies that aren't very violent. But of course, that's the other way around. That's one of the reasons they live so long, because people who die by violence are typically younger people. Whether that's, you know, soldiers in a war or people who live in the kind of culture of endemic personal violence, you know, not to stereotype, but typically a lot of younger people involved in those. But what if an immortal society thought that there was a way to deal with the problem of violent death, a way to become truly immortal, not just not to die of old age, but to be unkillable? Under those circumstances, they might do anything for such a cure. So one thing I think I haven't talked about in this episode is the idea that immortality leads to terrible ennui. I think that's a very common view of immortality, the idea that life is ultimately wearisome. And I get this, but again, I feel like it's a not very interesting motivation. I guess you could have very old immortal characters who are completely jaded thrill seekers. I think that that might be interesting, that they're just constantly doing new and extreme things because they've literally been everywhere and done everything. They've been there, done that. And consequently, they wind up being willing to assist player characters in their harebrained schemes or hiring themselves out as wandering swordmasters to cackling villains because they just want to do something different and life doesn't hold that many surprises for them anymore. So maybe there's something to that, that they just want to recapture some of the thrill of a time when the world seemed full of new potential, and that's why they wind up in weird spaces a lot. So there's maybe something there. But also, another MacGuffin that they could be pursuing would be one that would allow them to reset, to be reborn. So I don't want to die, but I do want to experience things anew. Or I feel like if I could go back to my younger self with the benefit of 10,000 years of experience, like I, James Holloway, think that if I went into the life of my 20-year-old self, I could really give him a couple of handy pointers. There's a few bad habits that he could get out of. Wouldn't kill him to, like, get more regular exercise or, you know, learn another foreign language. Now imagine if that was thousands upon thousands of years. You know, you look back at your 300-year-old self and think, oh no, what an idiot I was. What if I had the chance to do it all over again, knowing what I know now? That's something that I feel like, you know, that's a blue jewel that you might be willing to do a lot of pretty unethical things in order to get. So I do think that it can be fun to give an immortal villain a motivation that is specifically related to their immortality rather than just wanting power, because you might think that such a villain would be beyond that need. Not necessarily. But if we're really trying to make them weird, then it would make sense to have them have transcended a lot of normal villainous motivations. All right, that is about all of the immortal monsters that I have time to talk about today. Paul, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, remember that if you'd like to be like Paul and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we are once again entrusting ourselves to the whims of fate. It's going to be another Monster Roulette episode. So I hope that you will join me for that right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram @MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.